twisting in the wind. Like at most county or state fairs, there are always people trying to promote a product and or service, and occasionally there are people there to entertain us with some sort of a gimmick. In particular, when I was at the Norfolk County Fair just this year, I was really taken with a guy named Bandolini. Have you seen this guy, the one-man man? I really liked him. I thought he was really fun. One such presentation I heard about was a case at a local fair where there was a carnival barker who shouted out to people to come and gather around for the most amazing feat of strength. And when a sufficient crowd had gathered, a huge man, rippling with muscles, took the stage and stood next to the MC, or the carnival barker. He proceeded in front of the crowd to lift enormous barbells. He even took to lifting up the back end, the heavy end of a tractor. And the crowd clapped in appreciation. And then the MC reached into his large pocket inside his jacket and took out a juicy orange. I mean, an incredibly juicy orange. He handed it to the muscle-bound man, who proceeded to squeeze the orange, and it squished out streams of orange juice. And the man, that big muscled man, squeezed and squeezed until there was nothing left but a mass of dried out pulp. And then the MC said that he would give $1,000 to anyone in the crowd who could come up on stage and squeeze just one drop of orange juice from the pulp that was left. Well, an excited murmur went through the crowd, and soon several very strong farmers, both men and women, rushed to the stage to give it a try, and they passed that pulp between each other, and no one could squeeze even one drop of orange juice out of that pulp. And finally, when all the people had wanted to try, had made an attempt, a very skinny, bespectacled man in the crowd asked if he could try. Well, the crowd sized him up and quickly chuckled at the thought that this little guy could get up and squeeze anything out of that. If all these strong people could not get anything out of that pulp, what chance did this little fellow have? But, you know, fair is fair, so the MC called him up to give it a try, and that slightly built man clambered up on stage, took the pulp, and gave it a squeeze, and you know what? Several drops of orange juice came out of his hand onto the stage. The MC and the crowd gasped in surprise. "But how?" stammered the MC. "You must be one of the strongest people in the world, despite your size." Oh, not at all," said the man. "I just happen to be an auditor for Revenue Canada." Today's gospel reading reminded me of an experience, and that's what also reminded me of this story, about something that happened to me several years ago when attending a joint youth group between my home church, Queensway Baptist in Brantford, and First Baptist Church in Brantford. The leader of the event was from First Baptist Church and was a student minister named Lloyd Hurlburt. Do you remember Lloyd? Remember Lloyd? During the devotional time, Lloyd asked a question that went on to provoke probably one of the liveliest discussions I ever had at a youth group. And I've never forgotten it. For some reason, we were discussing, I don't know why, because we were young guys full of vim and vigor, I don't know. But he began to discuss what masculinity really meant. And then out of the blue, at least it felt out of the blue to me, he suddenly asked us this bombshell question. Was Jesus manly? Now, to be perfectly honest, none of us were quite sure how to answer that question. And Lloyd pointed out to us, rightly, that our hesitation to be definitive in stating that Jesus was manly was, he believed, the product of all those years of us sitting in Sunday school and daily vacation Bible schools and hearing stories about Jesus who depicted him as being meek and mild. And now they're comforting images, especially for children. But you know what? It also made Jesus seem soft and cuddly. And at times, even crossing into something of a doormat when the religious leaders would step all over him. At least that's the picture we had. So I wonder, in your mind, is Jesus manly? How do you picture him? Now, I cannot prove it, but I suspect that one of the reasons so many men struggle with their spirituality, even if it's politically incorrect to say so, is that they perceive Jesus as being soft. Even that famous portrait, we've all seen it, hanging up in Sunday school halls and in churches, has Jesus portrayed as an airbrushed supermodel selling hair product. And so one of the reasons that I think these last few weeks that we have journeyed through Matthew is so important is that the picture that emerges of Jesus is anything but soft. In Matthew 21:12, Jesus goes in and he clears out the temple. He also, in this series of stories, is aggressively and sometimes cryptically leaving those Pharisees and others speechless. He tells parables that are provocative and subversive. He uses them like ideological weapons against his opponents. Remember a couple weeks ago I said, it's like he was poking the bear. Then when they challenge him, like today, with tricky questions regarding the law and taxation and the resurrection, he turns the whole discussion around on them and he leaves them speechless. If nothing else, a lesson here is that we've got to be incredibly cautious in picking and choosing stories about Jesus that depict him as being one-dimensional. Yes, Jesus was welcoming, he was friendly, he was forgiving, he provided nurture to hurting people, but boy, he was so much more. As we've seen over the last few weeks, Jesus has demonstrated that sometimes in this life, there are things worth getting worked up over. Things worth arguing about. Issues that call on us to be forthright as well as loving. Especially when it comes to issues of justice and righteousness. I suspect that one of the reasons we hesitate to think of Jesus as being assertive, and yes, this might be hard for us to accept, is that we do not know how to mesh the true picture of Jesus with our ideas about what love is. We erroneously think that being people of love or doing what Jesus would do means grinning and bearing injustice and prejudice and even sin sometimes. Because we think somehow that's the loving thing to do. In other words, we suffer in silence and we allow other people to suffer in silence. The reality is, therefore, that we have twisted a sense of what it means to love God and to love others. Because right in the heart of this confrontation, I mean right in the heart of it, Jesus states what is the most important two things in this world. And clearly, Jesus sees no contradiction between what he says and what he does and his call to love. There's no contradiction in his mind. So it appears we really do not understand what love is really all about, at least as Jesus talks about it and as he lives it out. Now, we all know in our culture, we throw around the word love like it's a synonym for like, don't we? We say things like, I love chocolate, and frankly, who doesn't? Or, I love my boyfriend or girlfriend because they make us happy. We love our spouses because they complete us. But in all these examples, there's a common element. It's emotion. This kind of love is actually a very passive thing. In these encounters, we sit back and we wait. We wait to see if that person or that thing makes us feel good. We either feel affection for them or that thing, or we do not. That's why couples ridiculously talk about, I still scratch my head on this one. I wish someone would explain it to me. Couples talk all the time about falling into and out of love. I don't get it. The love Jesus is espousing here is not a passive love at all. It's not even strictly emotional. You know, in the Bible, there are lots of references to love, but Jesus is being specific. He's quoting Deuteronomy 6, verse 5. And the Bible is clear in its presentation that God chose to love Israel above all other nations to express his love for them. It was, according to the scriptures, an act of will. To love God in Deuteronomy is to choose to love God. Feelings are not part of the equation. We perhaps have all heard sermons that have included the idea that, or told us the idea that the Greek word agape is the word Jesus uses here. And it's different from other Greek words for love, like philia, which means brotherly love, or eros, which defines passionate or sexual desire. And did you know that those latter two are hardly ever used in the New Testament? But agape is all over the place. And even though there might be some emotion attached to agape, it's not its defining nature. Another way to describe this is to say that Jesus is really talking about loving kindness. It's an act of mercy. It is marked by generosity. It is a choice, not a feeling. And this helps us understand today's text better, because if we think of loving God as an emotional thing, you know what? We're going to come up short all the time. I mean, how can you conjure up feelings for something or someone that is so mysterious and who at times seems so remote? And that brings me to one of my chief concerns about Christian music. And I've talked to Nancy and Jim about this, especially when it comes to contemporary music, but not exclusively. Quite a bit of the music is intentionally crafted to elicit emotion. Emotion for God and emotion for Jesus. In many cases, you could take some of these pieces and you could take the name Jesus or God out of it and put your sweetheart's name into it, and it would be make grammatical and musical sense. And sometimes when I hear music like that, I think, oh, we're trying to woo God. We're trying to romanticize him. I understand how this happens. There's a lot about God in Christ that is beautiful, that's heartwarming, that's touching. It's hard not to be moved by the powerful stories and even our worship and experience of God. And that's okay. What should concern us is this. Can we love God and can we love our neighbor when we don't feel like it? When we have to overcome our feelings or simply ignore them and act with mercy to someone else. In this discussion, there needs to be honesty or frankness. There are, as we all know, times when loving God, as Jesus calls us to, can be incredibly challenging. Maybe, dare I say it, impossible. Maybe in our brokenness or when we're beaten down by life, we question God's goodness. We wonder why we should even bother to try and love him. But again, we almost always strive for that feeling of love, not agape. We think our love for God should just sort of happen, as it should for our neighbors, that it should be a passive thing. True love of God and others has an intentionality about it. For example, what parent in this world has ever felt 100% of the time, felt 100% of the time loving towards their child? Anybody been able to do that? Maybe you've heard this story before. I love it. And two men were in a local coffee shop and they were talking with each other. And the one man proceeded to tell his friend about how much grief his son was causing him. The young man was getting into so much trouble and it was just keeping his father up at night. And the other man replied, "Well, if he were my son, I'd have tossed him out of my home on his ear." To which the other man said, "Well, if he were your son, I would have tossed him out too. But he's my son, and I love him." You see, that's intentional love. Love that's a product of the will. A love evidenced in the act of mercy. How many times have we known someone whose spouse or children are making their lives, can I say it, hellish? And we wonder, how do they put up with that? How do they get through that day? You already know the answer. It's agape. You see, when our actions are equal to everybody, whether it makes us feel good or not, we are beginning finally to love both God and neighbor as Jesus intended us. It's not easy, but it wasn't easy for God either, was it? Israel, time and time again, sinned and broke their covenant with God. Time and time again, God forgave them and reconciled with them. God gave his all as an act of love, namely through Jesus. So can we love those that we find dirty or repugnant? Because you know, the Pharisees couldn't. That's the point here. The challenge of Jesus' words comes when we recognize that as Christ followers, we often use love as an excuse to the path of least resistance. When confronted with the need to express mercy to someone, we think Jesus is telling us, well, it's okay not to because you don't feel the love. Instead, Jesus is calling us to a love that leads to excellence. Love, as Jesus presented, is calling out to us to keep us from being hypocritical. In James 2:15-16, we read these words. If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says to them, "Go in peace, keep warm, and eat your fill," and yet does not supply their bodily needs, what good is that? The problem with our interactions with other people begins with the fact that we often relate to others by considering what we need, what they can do for us. This is so ingrained in us that when someone approaches us, we often respond, "How? What do you want?" Our appreciation and interest in someone is often predicated on what they can do for us. Do you remember the story about Jesus who was invited to go to a dinner in Luke 14? And he's having this dinner and all of a sudden he says this. When you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends or your brother or your relatives or rich neighbors in case they have to invite you in return. And you would have to, or you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor and the crippled and the lame and the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. How soon we forget that God created us not because he needed us. Please hear that. He didn't need us. He wanted us. He made you and I and everyone else for the sheer love of it. Mike Mason points out that, strictly speaking, he says, "I don't know that I'm needed in this world." It's pretty profound, really. "It seems to me that the world would carry on pretty well if I wasn't around. Would it make any difference if there was one less star in heaven? No, that extra star is not there because it's needed. but because it was wanted. Knowing that I'm wanted by God and wanted by other people is more mysterious and also more freeing than feeling that I'm needed. It is far better, Jesus is telling us, to want God and to want people rather than simply needing them. Can we want a person who is economically disadvantaged or is broken in spirit and who cannot in any way, shape, or form give us anything we need? Can we love them? Examine, therefore, Jesus' interaction with those that the Pharisees did not want. Zacchaeus, remember him? One of my favorite stories. Zacchaeus had nothing Jesus needed. Nothing. In fact, when Jesus reached out to Zacchaeus, it was costly. His reputation was going to take a terrible beating. But you know what? Jesus didn't care. Why? Because Jesus wanted Zacchaeus. And because Jesus wanted Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus in turn wants other people. Remember how he said that if he defrauded anyone, he would pay them back four times the amount. He'd give away his money to the poor. Yes, Jesus had feelings for Zacchaeus, but that's not what motivated him. You know, it would have been horrible for all of us if God's love was predicated on his feeling good for us. Oh boy, that would have been scary. In the first epistle of John, we read, God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them. You know, I hear so often from people that they just don't understand God. And I get it that there's an unfathomable mystery to God. I get it. The truth, however, is that if we wish to know more about God, we must dwell in his presence. And if we want to dwell in God's presence, we need to be people of love. Intentional love. In loving God and our neighbor, we are known and we know. There's no other way to deepen our faith and to experience an abundant life.